The San Jose Sharks Audio Network is on 24 hours a day. Whether you're in the office or on the go, make sure that you download the Sharks SAP Center app and hit listen anytime. You can also find us on your computer by going to sjsharks.com/listen. If it's a game broadcast, breaking news, or a player feature, the place to find it is right here on the San Jose Sharks Audio Network.
Welcome to The Undercurrent. I'm your host, Tara Sloan. It is nice to be with you today. Listen, if you walk around the Bay Area, you can spot a Sharks fan from a mile away. That signature teal is pretty hard to miss. But there's another Sharks color scheme that's gained a lot of traction, and that's the gold and Pacific teal, to be precise, of the California Golden Seals. That's the NHL team based in Oakland from 1967 to 1976. It got me thinking, sure, the colors and the font are iconic, but what do people actually know about the Seals? I mean, I'm a hockey person, and until I started to do some digging, I really didn't know much at all. Well, the Golden Seals story is part comedy and part tragedy. It's a team that was set up to fail by one bad management decision after another, with some pretty wild PR stunts thrown in between. So who better to give us the full account than former Seals PR guy, journalist, and holder of the Seals legacy, Len Shapiro. Len, welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Tara. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, the reason that this struck some of us as a good idea to cover this topic right now is because there seems to be such a renewed interest in the Seals simply because of the fact that the Sharks have been wearing these reverse retros that have everybody talking. But it strikes me, and you know, I'm a longtime hockey person. I've worked in the NHL for a long time. I didn't know that much about the California Seals or the Golden Seals, and I think a lot of people don't. So you are the best person to help us revisit that time. So first of all, let's start with how the Seals were born. What's that story?
Well, the story is very simple. It was the second six expansion, 1966. Actually, they had the meetings and they decided to expand. One of the reasons they wanted to expand was to quash the Western Hockey League from becoming a big time league, which had San Francisco and LA in it. So immediately they granted franchises to San Francisco and Los Angeles to be a part of the second six of the NHL. And that's where the Golden Seals, Oakland Seals started.
Okay, so yes, let's get to the fact that they ended up in Oakland. How did that become their landing spot?
Well, basically Clarence Campbell said that the Cal Palace was not a sufficient building to play in. And at that time it wasn't, and really has never been. It was a Western Hockey League home of the Western Hockey League Seals, but it was an ancient building built in 1939. The sight lines were not that great. And also the Seals were a farm club of the Boston Bruins, and the actual rink size was 185 by 85, not the 200. So they wanted to bring it up to specs, and the Oakland Coliseum, which was being built at that time, was going to be 85 by 200. So it was very simple procedure, also a brand new building, 12,000 seats. They made the move and awarded the franchise to Oakland, not San Francisco.
So Len, when did you start working with the team?
Well, I covered the team at the beginning in 1967 when they came here. I was working for a local radio station, but I started in January of 74. So I started before the 74-75 season when the National Hockey League took over the team.
Right.
I didn't work in the office immediately. I worked down the street because they didn't want me associating with Charles Finley. So when Finley finally vacated the office, I moved into the office in basically, I believe it was August of 74.
Okay, so we're going to get to the famous Finley era, mm-hmm. Because that's certainly worth revisiting. But okay, so you cover the Seals from the beginning. I guess, how would you describe their success or journey from the start?
Well, unfortunately, it's a series of unfortunate not being capitalized enough. There was not enough money to make this franchise go. The original owner, Barry Van Gerbe, came in and expected the seats to be full. He thought it'd be sellouts from day one, and it wasn't. It was hard work. It was moving from across the bay. The basic audience of the Seals at that time was on the peninsula and in San Francisco from the Western League days. And the famous line is the bridge is 1,000 miles from San Francisco to Oakland, but from Oakland to San Francisco, it's 10 miles.
Right.
So people did not want to make the trip over to Oakland to see the Seals. And then the way it started with not a competitive team, it really turned off the fans again from the peninsula. So they had to develop a new area of influence. And it was very difficult to do that with very little money.
So attendance wasn't great. The team got off to a rough start and their road schedule was pretty bad, right?
Yes. They started off with 2 home wins and then they went on the road for, I think it was 7 games and lost all 7 of those. And they lost 11 games total before they got their 3rd win. So at that point, Barry Van Gerbing was, panicking by the fact that no tickets were being sold. And eventually he decided that he wanted to sell the team. So right out the bat, even out of the gate, the team was being sold to another city.
Wow. So there was movement, I remember, to move the team to Vancouver or Buffalo. Why did it end up staying put?
Basically, because the CBS television contract called for 2 teams in California.
Ah.
They couldn't move it out. They wanted these major markets for the broadcast, the CBS game of the week. And if they moved it to another city, they would lose either San Francisco. They felt LA would then fail also because of travel commitments and the cost of traveling to Vancouver or wherever. And eventually they just decided that they would not allow the team to move ever.
You know, it seems kind of funny now because you think of NHL players and, they want to play in warm destinations. They want to play in San Jose. They want to play in LA. They want to play in Sunrise. But back then, this was, a group of people who'd grown up playing hockey who were not used to temperatures like we have in the Bay Area. So what's your recollection of some of the players and their difficulty adjusting to the climate?
Well, they adjusted very well to the climate because they went out and played golf every day.
Oh, how did that affect their game?
Yes, I would think it did affect the game. Again, the practices were very strange. We practiced at the Coliseum. They practiced at East Ridge Rink. They practiced at Berkeley Iceland. But basically, it was just beautiful surroundings, very distractive surroundings. The golf was easy to get to. And I think that distracted the players a little bit at the start when they first came here. They found this to be a wonderful area to live, wonderful area to grow up in, as you said, the climate. And all those factors came in where eventually the players just went off into space.
Okay, well, they did have some success in their second season, right? They did make the playoffs.
Yes, they did make the playoffs.
So what did the viewership grow? Did their fan, did fans come flocking at that point?
Not really. Again, no. It was a question of letting people know who the players were. Mm. There was a great problem of identification of players. They had drafted players from the East Coast originally. I think, again, one of my big complaints, and I was probably off base, but they should have drafted a lot of the Western Hockey League players who the people in this area knew and were attuned to. Like, they did keep Charlie Burns, one of the captains of the Western League team. But again, overall, the players were unknowns. Mm. And they couldn't attract the players because, again, they didn't have the money to promote the players. They couldn't get them out, couldn't get them to places, getting them to speaking engagements. The players would rather go out and play golf.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's not feeling like a great place to play, then why not?
I mean, okay, does that really answer your question? I think it does.
Yeah.
The fact that there was really no identification.
Yeah.
Even in the second year, they couldn't build up the players. And also, they started trading the players. If a player was relatively decent, he might have gotten traded off. And the people would say, why do you keep trading these players? Why don't you keep a couple of them? And that was another complaint about the team, is it was always in flux.
Right. And that never stopped. I want to get to the Charlie Finley years. So this is the Oakland A's owner who bought the team in 1970, and he didn't know anything about hockey. Am I right?
Yes, he came out in the press conference right after he buys the team and says, "I know nothing about hockey." Well, right there should have been a hint. But going back to that meeting in Chicago, if I might take a step back, when he actually bought the team, they had the meeting in Chicago because Van Gerbing just couldn't sell the team, basically gave it back to the NHL and said, "You guys deal with it." And they had the meeting there, and they had only two people show up, Charlie Finley and Jerry Seltzer of roller derby. Well, when it came down to the bottom line, is that the NHL owners were old fashioned. They wanted a deal with one person. They found out that Jerry Seltzer, who had a much better presentation, was being backed by National Football League owners. Hmm. That the Oakland Raiders owner, the Buffalo Bills owner, were part of the background of who was going to, you know, run the team if Seltzer took over. They said, "No, we want to deal with one person," and that was going to be Charlie Finley. So Finley brought in like a one-page proposal. He got the team.
I mean, just if you could imagine if the deal had gone differently and Seltzer could have been involved, what do you see happening to the team if that
happened? I think it still would be here. I think would be here. I think he had the muscle in the media. You know, he had the roller derby on. He had TV. He had radio people. He had, actually, believe it or not, they had newspaper coverage, even though it was small. Mm-hmm. I think he still had newspaper coverage. And I think he would have been able to generate more interest in the team because he knew how to get the players out, get them out to speaking engagements, et cetera. But here was this 150-page, you know, well-done presentation, and it was tabled. Wow. It just made no sense.
Okay. So that's sad. That's a sad story.
It is a sad story.
So the Charlie Finley years begin. He thinks he knows how to market this game. Did the budget go up, or it was just sort of publicity stunts and shenanigans?
It was publicity stunts and shenanigans. He didn't have the money because the A's really weren't a money-generating team even in those days. He tried to do things, you know, half-price nights, barber nights. He had the barber shop group come over to the Edgewater Hyatt, had him you know, talks about hockey at players. Unfortunately, the only thing they left was the bar. They stayed in the bar and drank, and the barbers went back to their places and really didn't talk that much about the hockey. So that was kind of a failed promotion that they really hoped would work, and it didn't. And again, other things they did, the big one was, and I think he doesn't get enough credit for it, is names on the back of the jerseys.
So was he the first in the NHL entirely?
Yes, he was. He was
That's
the first.
Unreal.
Yes, because, you know, the reason why, you said it kind of at the beginning of this, he didn't know the players. He's looking down the ice. He didn't know who Gil Melosh was from Bob Stewart. I mean, he needed the names on the back, and that started the whole thing. Now, on the road, when they went to Toronto and Chicago, they had to carry two uniforms because Toronto wanted to sell programs. And they felt that if the names were in the back of the players, they wouldn't sell any programs. Uh-huh. And the same in Chicago. They said, "No, you got to wear blank uniforms when you play in our building." So that was kind of a side issue. But again, as soon as it went, guess what? Now all the teams, all 32 teams, have names on the backs of their jerseys. And that started with Charlie Finley. Second thing Finley amazing. Did was the colorful jerseys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Chicago Blackhawks had the emblem, but it was just a white uniform. So he brought in the color when he converted the Seals to his Oakland A's colors. California gold, Fort Knox gold, they called it both, Kelly green, and wedding gown white. Those were the colors of his Oakland A's. He brought those on the team, and it was pretty soon, all of a sudden, you started seeing other teams come up with colors. And again, Finley started that aspect, and he doesn't get enough credit for that. Even though he was a terrible owner, he had two major things that hockey, you know, drew.
Len, one thing that didn't stick was the white skates.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Again, the shoes for the Oakland A's were white shoes that he used, and he felt that that would be a good way of doing it. But he didn't think about the fact white skates on white ice, that wouldn't work. Also, when pucks hit it and left black marks, you'd have to continuously paint them to keep them white. And pretty soon the skates had weight to them. You know, they had all this layers of paint on them, and the players were starting to complain. Bill Torrey, who was the general manager, wanted the skates to match the uniforms. He said, let's do green and gold skates. That would have probably been much more successful.
Another thing that he did was, didn't he start to fly the team in first class? It wasn't charter yet, right? They were still flying commercial.
Yeah, there were no charters in those days, so he would fly the team's first class. And also sometimes on the way to Vancouver, they were in coach. So, I mean, he started really heavily moving the team to try to get him to do better by getting him in a much more relaxed flight pattern, and he put him in first class. That never really worked either.
Okay. So, that's sort of on the publicity end of things, trying to also get your players, psychology working, but from a hockey perspective and a management perspective, what happened under his tenure?
He would not sign players to contracts. He would not, up the price, up the contract value. And of course that started when the WHA showed up in 71-72. 10 players jumped to the WHA because he wouldn't match their contracts. Also, there's one story where Gary Young, the general manager, signed Dickie Redmond to a $100,000 contract, which was unheard of in those days, and basically sent it into central office in the NHL. NHL called Finley up and said, why are you paying Dickie Redmond $100,000? He's not worth that much. That went back to Gary Young. He fired Gary Young the next day. He wouldn't develop the players. He wouldn't keep the players. Pretty soon, we basically had a minor league team in NHL jersey.
Man. There's a famous story that I would love you to tell about the Seals trading their first round draft pick for a player named Ernie Hickey. Can you recount that for us?
Well, that's one of the another major boondoggles of the Seals. We had the general manager, Frank Selke, who came from the Montreal Canadiens and Toronto Maple Leafs. He was close friends with the Montreal general manager, Sammy Pollock. Sammy Pollock was a master of manipulation. He said, hey, why don't you trade me the 1970 first round pick? I'll send you out Ernie Hickey and Francois Lacombe. Selke said, okay, why not? The Seals didn't have enough scouting information to know that Guy Lafleur was available. So pretty soon here, all of a sudden the draft comes up. Sammy Pollock picks Guy Lafleur and the Seals end up with nothing. I mean, Ernie Hickey, don't get me wrong, was a decent player. And I don't know, a lot of people speculate, would Guy Lafleur have saved the Seals? There's a big question that because he had no supporting cast.
Right.
In Montreal, he had a supporting cast. In Oakland, he may not have. So again, that's a big question. Yes, we lost Guy Lafleur, but would he have done that with the Seals? Yeah, you got to question that. But it was a boondoggle. It's probably the worst trade ever in the National Hockey League.
And that is not a badge of honor you want to wear.
No, but it just adds to the lore of the Seals making mistake after mistake after mistake.
Now, of course, there were some great players who came through here. And I doing my reading, I was like, oh, I didn't know Walt McKechnie played here. I didn't even know Reggie Leach came through. What are some names that we should know?
Well, I think you got to start off with our captain, Ted Hampson. He was a good player for the Seals. Basically, on the Seals roster, he's the all-time leading scorer. Al McAdam passed him by if you count the Cleveland Barons years. But Ted Hampson was a great player. Of course, Carol Vadney developed himself here, then got traded to Boston Bruins. Excellent player. Of course, our goaltenders, Gio Meloche. I mean, he faced unbelievable amount of shots every game and just did a wonderful job. And Gary Cobra Simmons, who came in to back him up in the last 2 years. He was an excellent goaltender. So, I mean, we had some players there. Defense, Bob Stewart came over from the Boston Bruins. He was a rugged defenseman, one of the only guys that really fought for the Seals. And I'm trying to think, we had Norm Ferguson, who was a rookie of the year in the Western Conference. He wasn't the NHL Calder Cup winner, but he was the Sporting News Rookie of the Year in the Western Conference. He had an excellent 2 years with the Seals and then jumped to the WHA. Again, that's some of the players that are really high on the list. Al McAdam did a great job. And of course, in the final one, Dennis Mrook.
Right.
He was a wonderful draft pick, came in here, sparked the team, they called him Pee Wee, short guy, dynamo, got the crowd, electrified. We had the Mrook cheer. We actually had a cheer for a player. We never had that before. And he was probably the most electric player we had.
Mm. I'm a big fan of Dennis. He's a lovely, lovely human being.
And then he went on to score 60 goals with the Washington Caps.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, so take me to the point where the team is now sold, taken over by the NHL. What happened?
Well, again, they got tired of Finley, obviously, and they said, look, let's get him out of there. They bought the franchise for him for $6.6 million just to get him out of the way. And the team started to develop a more rational approach to the future of hockey. Basically, they started to develop the minor league. They had a minor league team in Salt Lake City that Finley had bought, but had never really used. So they started developing players down in Salt Lake City, and we had a couple players developed down there. So that was one of the big aspects of the whole operation, was to get a minor league system developed where we had players developing and coming up. So that's the one thing the NHL did install. They brought in a tremendous coach, Jack Evans, who had been the coach in Salt Lake City. They brought him up to the NHL level, did a great job with the players because the players knew him, developed mm-hmm. through him, which was the first time that had ever happened in the Seals organization, where we had a complete flow of rookie players to the NHL. So that's what the NHL did. And then, of course, they went out to try to find a buyer. And where did they go? They went back to the original group that tried to buy the team. They went to the Mel Swig, who had owned part of the Western Hockey League Seals, and convinced him to take over the team. But at that point, I think it was too late. Again, the undercapitalized team in the past, the NHL didn't spend that much money. Matter of fact, I can say this, that my last year advertising budget was $5,000 for the whole year.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow.
And we basically blew that on season tickets in the Hayward Daily Review to try to sell season tickets. So that money ran out, and we had no other money to promote the team. And I just continually look back and say, geez, if we had even some money, we might have been able to click on this thing. And then with Swig, they had hoped that they would get a building in San Francisco because they felt Swig had the connections in San Francisco. And I went out with Munson Campbell, the president of the Seals at that time, and we measured 4th and Mission, where right now the Moscone Center is. And we measured it and figured that's where the arena should go. However, Swig got knifed in the back by George Moscone, the next mayor in town. He had Joe Alioto on his side. But Moscone comes in, and he goes under the pressure of the Chamber of Commerce that was desperately wanting a convention center to bring big business, big trips into San Francisco. Well, Moscone won. The building was quashed, and that's when the Seals basically, Swig gave up. He brought in a partner, George Gund, as we know, and Gund convinced Swig to move the team to Cleveland.
Yeah, so what's your recollection about that final game?
Well, the general public didn't know it was a final game. I knew it was a final game, and some of the people in the front office knew it was a final game, because February 1st, 1976, I went into the office on Hagenberger, and no one was there. It was just me and Loretta Marcus, the secretary. We just looked at each other and said, where is everybody? And as good employees as we are, we went into Munson Campbell's office and snooped. And we saw on his calendar, book the Cleveland Hilton. And at that point, we both looked at each other and said, that's where we're going. Because there had been rumors of Seattle, Denver, Houston, all over. But this was the first concrete thing we'd seen to say the team was going somewhere. And we saw the Cleveland Hilton. At that point, we both knew that that's where the team would end up. But we didn't know, the general public didn't know. It was secret until, actually secret until July 14th, 1976, in the summer, when it was announced that the NHL had agreed to move the team to Cleveland.
Do you remember how you felt that day?
Empty.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I thought we would have a better chance with more money possibly coming in, with a better ownership group. George Gund had the money, that maybe we'd be able to spend something on it and, you know, promote the team better, get more people in there, and of course, get better players. You know, players would stay here and develop. But I felt very empty, and I'd followed the teams from day one, and all of a sudden I realized, well, there's not going to be any hockey here again. Mm-hmm. You know, it just didn't make sense to us. And again, it just it was a shock that the team would move out of the Bay Area, because we felt that because of that CBS contract at the beginning, which really wasn't in effect, I don't think it was in effect in 76, that the team would stay here. But again, all of a sudden, the next day we know, well, not the next day, but July 14th, mm-hmm. it moves to Cleveland.
I mean, as kind of twists and turns throughout the journey of this team, obviously it's, you know, altogether, it's a bit of a hockey tragedy in some ways, but, but also, as you say, it's lore, it's folklore, and probably feels much better now that there is a successful team in the Bay Area. But what were some of the fun parts of being involved in this organization?
Well, the Booster Club was great. We had 800 people as members of the Booster Club at the High Point, and we'd have events over at the Edgewater High and House. We had the awards dinner. We had picnics. It was really a close group of people, 800 people. But we had the beginnings, I thought, of a great organization and a great fan base to build this team to a better situation. But we never really got the chance because, again, the underlying current through this whole thing, undercapitalized, we couldn't really capitalize on the situation. Mm-hmm. The other things were the events that we had or the things that happened. Of course, we had the streaker.
Right.
And we had Crazy George. I was lucky enough to sign him to his first professional contract. He had been working down at San Jose State and been coming up to our games and really getting the crowd motivated. So we decided in the last year to hire him and put him under contract. And we paid him just a tremendous salary of $25 a game, two tickets, and a parking pass.
Oof, that's good.
Big time. That was big for us.
Yeah.
And he came up and generated a crowd, and he did a great job. That's one of the highlights of the Seals history, is starting Crazy George on his professional journey through the cheerleading ranks.
Can you just say a little bit more about the skating streaker for those who may not know who that was?
Well, I wasn't part of it. Some of the minor crew kids knew this girl that was willing to do it. They recruited her. All of a sudden, in the middle, between the second and third periods, all of a sudden, here she comes out of the player gate wearing nothing but stickers, and she skates across the ice, and the crowd goes nuts, and she goes out the Zamboni entrance, and over, no one really saw it. In the back, there's Crazy George with a fur coat to put around her, so she didn't stay streaking very long, but it went over. I mean, I think that was the only streaker the NHL really ever had. And we were lucky enough to do it and stage it.
My goodness, times have changed, isn't that
yes,
so?
Yes. We all be in jail probably now for that. But that's a whole nother story. But again, that's two events there that really were happy events for us, for the Seals. They really, the streaker and Crazy George really brought happiness to a lot of people.
But Len, you know, you're sort of the keeper of this story for this part of the world. And you've still worked with the Booster Club in keeping these memories alive. Why is that important to you?
Well, just the sake that it was the first NHL club here. I made a lot of friends through it, had a lot of, you know, fans that I met over the years that I still communicate with, players I still communicate with. Again, Gary Simmons, the goaltender, became my business partner. We opened up some Roundtable Pizzas in the East Bay. So again, it has a lot of connection to me, and I just like to keep it going. And I hope that makes some sense.
It makes a lot of sense. How did you feel when the Sharks came to town?
Well, I was happy to see the NHL back. I mean, it was important to get it back. I knew it would be successful if the right ownership group had it and if it was in the right city, mm-hmm. either San Francisco or San Jose. At that point, San Jose was coming up in the world. Either place would have worked, and as far as I'm concerned, San Francisco being the media center, I wish the Seals had been in San Francisco, because where the building would have been, we could have walked to the Chronicle, we could have walked to the Examiner, the TV stations were right there. Just a side point, when we were in Oakland, the film crews for the major TV stations had to leave at the end of the first period because they had to go back to their stations to develop the film.
Oh my God.
If we had been in San Francisco, maybe they might have stayed for the whole game and gone to their studios to develop the film. So that was another strategic element that was missing. But when San Jose started developing, and then you have cable TV, you can pick off the highlights off the TV for the TV stations, whole different world of operation versus in those days when you had limited resources.
So Len, finally, and thank you so much for this. This is so interesting. It's such a fascinating story. Why is the legacy of the Seals important, and why should more people know about them?
Well, again, it was the start of NHL in the Bay Area. They had some decent players. We had some name players. And I think the identification of the Seals and just the 9 years that we're here, all the strange things that happened, all the stories that happened, you know, again, just make a quick back to Gilles Mélage. The Chicago Blackhawks traded Gary Desjardins to the Seals. They forgot to tell the Seals he had a broken arm. And that's the time Finley actually responded. He called up Clarence Campbell, said, "Hey, this is ridiculous. How can they trade a player with a broken arm? I want a goaltender." And I think behind the scenes, Clarence Campbell sent Gilles Mélage to the Seals. And that's how he came here. So there's all those stories that, you know, we could go hours for all the stories that happened in the history of the Seals. And that's why it's so interesting to people. They say, "God, what's next? What happened next?" 9 years, a lot happened.
It was truly the Wild West, it sounds like. Len, I can't thank you enough for your time. This has been so entertaining and so informative. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to do it, Tara. Anytime we can talk about the Seals, it's happy time for me.
I love it. Thanks, Len. Isn't Len just awesome? And what an incredible story the Seals are. I love seeing Len around the tank. Len is a lifer and so devoted to hockey in this market and just a gem of a human being. So Len, thank you. I'm so grateful for you. Thanks for taking the time. And to everyone out there listening, thank you so much for tuning in. I'll be back next week with another edition of The Undercurrent. In the meantime, keep your fins above water.